Welcome to The Honest Report, a weekly podcast analyzing media coverage of the Arab Israeli conflict, anti-Semitism, and radical Islamic terrorism.
They attacked by air, land, and sea, taking Israel by surprise during a major Jewish holiday. Now, 13 and a half hours after Hamas launched its audacious assault, Israel says it's at war.
Israel is at war. We didn't want this war. It was forced upon us in the most brutal and savage way. But though Israel didn't start this war, Israel will finish it.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says when it comes to destroying Hamas, quote, nobody will stop us.
Here's your host, Rob Walker.
In the immediate aftermath of Hamas's invasion of southern Israel on October 7th, it became evident that Israel lacked the ability to scale up its procurement of military and civilian gear, both for the IDF and its counter-terror operations, and for the large number of Israeli civilians forced from their homes and displaced refugees in their own country. In the face of fast-changing events, one Israeli man, Michael Friedman, saw an opportunity to help. The Israel-based businessman quickly launched what became known as Project Shushan, a complex effort to deliver much-needed gear to Israel, working faster than official channels could provide. Michael joins us as our guest this week. Welcome to the Honest Report podcast. Michael Friedman, welcome to the Honest Report podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Pleasure is all ours to have you. I'm fascinated with some of the work that that you've been doing. You, of course, you live in Israel. You're an Israeli, and following what happened on October 7th, you really completely pivoted and recognized a very significant challenge that was much bigger than simply the military impact and the human disaster that was taking place, but there was something much bigger. What was happening behind the scenes that you noticed wasn't being addressed?
Well, I started by moving myself on October the 8th to Athens, where I have another home. And on arrival, I could see that there were Israelis strewn around the airport in various states of distress. And that's how this story started. I realized that I needed to try and help them to get back to Israel as soon as possible, and that it was something that may be at some scale. The Israeli government suggested through news and social media that this was the best route home for people who were left without tickets, and to expect 15,000 to 20,000 Israelis to come through Athens Airport. So I pulled together a team of volunteer friends of mine, and we built a plan in conjunction with Chabad of Athens, who have been just marvelous. And we triaged 15,000 Israelis and helped them to get home as quickly and safely as possible. During that time, we met hundreds and hundreds of soldiers. We helped those soldiers to get back home without having to wait for the military airlift, which was what most of them were expecting to be their route home. So we had one airlift instead of having one a day for several days, as we were expecting. And the rest of them, we got home in the jump seats of planes on discounted tickets and so on and so on. And because of those trusted relationships that we built with these soldiers, they started to come back to us and say, if you could fix Athens Airport at 24 hours of notice, you can probably help us with some of our own procurement needs. There's all sorts of gear that either we're missing or just won't get to us quickly enough, or that isn't really at the standards that we would like given the people that we think we're going to face. So we had quite early intel from some of the people on the ground that there were, for example, particular types of munitions that Hamas have had access to that have popped up in the Russia-Ukraine conflict that need particular type of care if you're injured by one of them, thermobaric munitions, for example, which require a hemostatic gauze, which is, I don't want to get into too many technical details, partly because it's somewhat gruesome for this time of the day. But we realized that this was a piece of equipment that was necessary for combat medics to have. The IDF don't have it yet as standard. Hopefully that's changing now. And we were able to get in touch with the manufacturers, who thank goodness happened to be a nice Jewish family from Johannesburg. And we managed to get them to agree to give us crates and crates of this material at cost. We then did a rapid fundraising to be able to buy literally 4,000 or 5,000 of these gauzes and have them moved immediately to Israel and distributed to combat medics. That's just one example of many of the things that we found out were absolutely needed, and we were able to move faster than the official procurement chains. And that continues to be the case even today, 5 months into the war. Around that and any number of other issues of procurement, both for medical supplies, dual-use goods, all sorts of actually what should be quite basic things that the army does issue, but it doesn't issue to a standard that the soldiers find particularly comfortable. So, for example, we've procured much better boots for some of the soldiers in particular units where they're really in their boots for several days on end.
So that was my question, which is that, you know, of course, in any government department, procurement is a very complex logistical endeavor. And yet, I think a lot of people listening might be rather taken aback that this kind of thing wasn't necessarily as streamlined as expected. Is that a problem, or is this sort of just the way things unfortunately work, that they need to be able to scale up quickly, but that there's not a huge amount of this kind of weaponry or gauze or what have you stored?
Sure.
But tell us.
I think it's a very good question. I'm obviously not an official government spokesman or employee. After the war, I'm quite sure that there will be a very deep dive on procurement and supply chain for the IDF and all of the various flaws that they may have had in their system. But in mitigation, it should be said that everything that happened on and subsequent to October the 7th was completely unprecedented. It's why 5 months later, we're all in some phase of shell shock here. It was not conceivable for the IDF to be able to supply the 300,000 men that they suddenly called up with the very latest equipment. That just hasn't happened in Israel's history since the Yom Kippur War. So I don't think that they can be entirely blamed for that situation. And similarly, there are supply chain issues in every army in the world when you're trying to get the very latest equipment in real time. Normally, you know, you require a lengthy procurement process. It takes several months just to get all the forms together, to make payments. And they just weren't prepared for being able to do this in a tearing hurry. One of the things that we've done is we've taken the lessons that we've learned. We came up with a couple of structures in terms of both being able to provide funding and to get access to goods and to capture the goodwill of the many people around the world who wanted to send equipment and or funds to Israel, to be able to harness that in future as a contingency plan for the Israeli government. And we're hoping that they will at some point talk to us and accept that we've done all of the work so that at least next time this is made easier. So I don't want to criticize what happened. The scale and speed at which things happened were just so completely unprecedented. Having said that, what we were able to do was to react much more quickly because we had such direct access to people in the field, to understand that they were seeing things that the IDF just didn't have. If they did have the intelligence, it certainly wasn't reflected in the way that they were supplying, for example, their combat medics. And again, I hold them harmless for that. I personally believe that there are wider actors who are supporting Hamas. It's not just Iran that we all know about. They seem to have an amazing amount of materiel that comes straight off the Ukraine-Russia battlefield. I'll leave it to your listeners' imaginations to join the dots as to how that might have happened. And so there are things that I think the IDF couldn't possibly have prepared at scale for. At least we now have those lessons, and at least we were able to do things at surprising scale and speed to at least mitigate the effects of what the IDF are facing. And we have had firsthand reports from the soldiers that we've provided this gear to that it's actually saved lives directly in the field, which is fantastic.
Well, almost 6 months into this war, your efforts have not ceased. This has only continued unabated. How has it shifted since October 7th, these procurement efforts?
Well, at the beginning, we were very focused on emergency medical equipment. Even within the first few days, that switched to a more proactive stance, which meant that we were looking at things like bringing drones into the field. There is, again, this is a classic thing of all armies around the world. There's a tendency to over-resource things. So a classic army drone is something that costs thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars. It all has to be procured through a specific chain of command. And obviously, they have to be used very sparingly because they're very expensive. What most of the units in the field actually want is a common or garden drone that you can buy at any hardware store anywhere in the world, that they patch to be more secure from a military perspective, and that at the cost of a few hundred dollars is essentially disposable. And what they need is lots of those, because they just want to have some basic eyes and ears in the air above them. And so one of the things that we did was we swept the secondhand market in a couple of different countries. We got some discounts from some of the retailers, and we shipped drones in people's luggage through Athens Airport, because by then we'd established such close relationships with the various staff at the airport, the airlines, the security staff, that we were able to just ask people to carry things through for us, which was the quickest way to get things to the field. So we even had people who would ask us for a drone at 9 a.m. and by 4 p.m. we had a drone in the field from a foreign country, which is faster than the IDF procurement chain could have done it by quite a distance, as you can imagine, and at a fraction of the cost. And those kind of needs have evolved over time. So, and of course, the more that we've done this, the more that people talk and the more medics got in touch with us and said, actually, we would like this, we need that. We then started to get into some of the different specialist unit requirements. So we've done everything from providing upgraded boots to combat wedding, to thermal vests, to particular pairs of glasses that are required, ballistic glasses. We've done laser sights for which have been used on the tops of tanks because we've been able to find things that are easier to replace than the official supplies. In many ways, I don't think any of this is a bad thing. I think the beauty of how Israel runs, as you know, is that it's a citizen army, the IDF, and the whole country works because people build it together. And there's a great extent to which, not to get too philosophical, but I think that this has been the reason for the unity we see is because this has been a return to the way that Israel created itself in the first place, that it's powered by the people. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. And I think for me, the lesson the IDF ought to learn is not to criticize itself overly for having dropped the ball in various ways, but to look at it the other way, which is how do we harness the fact that everybody picked up the ball, both Israelis in the IDF, the Israeli public, and then reaching out to their networks in the Jewish diaspora and their other supporters so that all of these gaps could be backfilled so quickly and so reasonably priced. That, for me, is the right lesson to take out of this.
Now, it's remarkable, some of these stories, from the airport luggage, it sounds almost like a Hollywood movie. What kind of limitations? I'm surprised hearing this, that a lot of this was able to, maybe pass muster isn't the term, but able to be exported. What kind of limitations that you can share with us exist that allow you to perhaps do things where, the military at large might be more constrained?
Well, firstly, I should say that we definitely didn't break the law anywhere. We were very careful. We actually took some advice where it was necessary to do so. We approached the Israeli embassy to give us some diplomatic cover where it was necessary. So everything we did and everything that I'm telling you, I'm happy to obviously put on record or I wouldn't be speaking to you about it. We understood that the nature of where we were was that we had to act in the most expedient manner possible. And because of the way that we had handled matters at the airport, we made it so efficient for the airlines, which in Athens are entirely staffed by non-Israeli, non-Jewish, purely Greek staff. We made it so easy for them to deal with what would have been an extraordinarily stressful situation that they trusted us to be in and around the terminal and near the passengers. And we spoke to simply members of the Israeli public, explained the circumstances that we were trying to move goods back and why. And with the assistance of the security staff to make sure that everything we were moving was firstly legal, secondly safe, and thirdly that we weren't asking anyone to do anything untoward, it was just the most efficient way to move things back was to just get people to carry it for us. And obviously, we had the correct arrangements in place so that the correct customs duties were paid on arrival in Israel. Most of our goods we were thankfully able to get exempted. So there was a lot of maneuvering in gray areas to make sure that things happened as quickly as possible, but that's what happens in war. So it was definitely exciting. And it did feel a little bit movie-like at times, I can tell you that.
And so what are the long-term sort of lessons do you think that the Israeli government and the IDF needs to be taking, or that you think will be taking from some of the procurement efforts that you've undertaken? Is that are these efforts that the military can take on, or is there always going to be a need for smaller, more nimble players to be able to augment sort of official channels?
That's a great question. And the way that we've looked at it is that there is a middle ground. So we have conceptualized this as what I would loosely call a gray market. So our idea is that in any future situation such as this, the Israeli government and the IDF already know that they have a network in place of people who are sympathetic to making the acquisitions that are necessary and can harness the goodwill and funding of the Jewish community and have access to the right supplies which fit with IDF standards, and that they can simply press a button and activate this kind of parallel market to the IDF's main procurement effort. By doing so, they guarantee that the supplies are at the correct quality. They can ensure that we synchronize inventory. We can tell them what we've bought and which units everything has gone to. And we also came up with an idea for an emergency funding structure. One of the problems that any government has is that they're actually surprisingly unable to write checks on the day for things. It's not like there's a government credit card and they can just buy $500,000 worth of boots from a factory. It's surprisingly more complicated than that. Whereas benefactors around the world can and absolutely have done that kind of thing. What we would like to do is create a structure of promissory notes so that anybody who lays out on behalf of the government to make these kind of purchases in the future, on the basis that they've been done through the correct channels and that it's at the right standards, can later get reimbursed by the government. And that would step you around this cash flow problem. And it's also not appropriate that these kind of things have to be bought purely by people making charitable donations. This is something that Israel can afford as a country and should pay for. So we see it all as a potential for a slightly more organized middle ground. We don't think that it's one extreme or the other. It doesn't have to be all government or all bailouts. There's something in between.
Michael, how can people follow your efforts with Project Shushan?
We have two different ways of doing that. The first is that we have set up a campaign which people can follow both the story of what we're doing and make contributions to if they want to support us. I should also add that we're very keen that this isn't just a question of us making purchases. We've designed this as a kind of consultancy. So if anybody that is listening to this has set up their own war room and wants to make their own direct purchases because they happen to have a unit that they want to support, we're happy to act as consultants to try and help you to get your costs down, find the best suppliers, make sure it's all at the correct standards, help you to get goods into the country quickly and cheaply, and so on. So you'll find means of contacting us there. And the second is that I have my own podcast where we go quite in depth about everything that I've talked about today and our wider strategic analysis of what's going on so that we can be a little more prepared for whatever is coming next. And that is called Transported, and you can find that on Spotify and all other big podcast outlets.
Wonderful. Michael, thank you so much for your time and for your efforts.
Not at all. Appreciate it.
And that's today's edition of the Honest Report podcast. If you haven't done so yet, please subscribe to our mailing list, our podcast channel, and follow us on social media for the most up-to-date news. If you like what you've heard, please consider a donation to support our continued efforts at www.honestreporting.ca/donate. Until next time, thank you so much for listening.